Hello, listeners, and welcome to CMI's Peace Talks. I'm your host, Antti Ämmälä, CMI's Communications Manager. In this show, we look at the world through the lenses of peacemaking. We have conversations with both our own and other top experts on what it takes to build lasting peace in this unstable world situation. In the wise words of our founder, Nobel Peace Laureate Martti Ahtisaari, we believe that all conflicts can be resolved. This podcast is about how to do it. It's been 20 years since the United Nations Security Council adopted a landmark resolution to strengthen women's role in peacemaking. Still, after two decades, there are far more ballpoint pens and middle-aged men present at the peace table than women. Why the progress has been so slow, and how, above all, to walk the talk and turn words into concrete action. As this episode is aired on International Women's Day, there couldn't be a better moment to reflect on this. My guests today are Anne Meskanen, who is a leading expert in the Department for Africa and the Middle East at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Finland, and Itonde Kakoma, CMS Program Director. A warm welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this year marks the 20th anniversary of the Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security. In year 2000, with this resolution, the UN formally acknowledged the severe impact of conflicts on women and the crucial role women should play in preventing and resolving these conflicts. Anne, you have a long experience in promoting women's role in peacemaking. You've worked as an ambassador for global women's issues and gender equality, and you're also a member of the Nordic Women Mediators Finland Network. Looking back 20 years, how would you describe the significance of the day when the Resolution 1325 saw light?
Yeah, thank you, Antti, and good morning, everybody. I think that this 1325, it's a real milestone resolution, of course, because when I think that 20 years ago, women and girls, they were mainly viewed and seen as victims of the conflict and not active players. And I have always said that I'm strongly against of this kind of issue that women are only victims. And I think that in general, it's also that the resolution somehow reformed the way we see and how we conduct nowadays the conflict analysis and engage in general in peacekeeping. And of course, that milestone resolution was also an answer to generations of neglect of women as peacemakers, as negotiators, as mediators, and as parties in the conflict. And I also think that this adoption of this Women, Peace and Security Resolution has led to an understanding that both women and men, they have the same rights to take decisions when it's a question about their future. As you said, I have a lot of experience from Afghanistan and Middle East countries, and I'm extremely pleased to see that also in the Middle East countries and Afghanistan, now they have all national action plans for 1325. And it is somehow important to know that with those national action plans, even though they are not ready, but somehow they, and women especially, they can respond better than before to the increase in vulnerability that conflicts are causing to women and girls.
What about you, Itande? How do you see the significance of this?
Well, resolution? I fully agree with Anne and would highlight a couple of points in addition. Firstly, to the best of our knowledge, it's the first time that the highest level international policy making body, the UN Security Council, dedicated serious discussion to the question of women and the particular role of women in not just peacekeeping, but peace mediation, peace building more broadly. So it raised the bar in terms of who should be convening discussions on these questions in addition to the advocacy world. Secondly, it provided the normative frameworks, which we still benefit from today. The challenge here And really, this speaks to, I think, what the various global Nordic, women mediation networks are trying to advance, as well as CMI, moving from norms to practice. And that really is the question today. One could argue that the rhetoric is there, is strong. Whether it's universally held is another question altogether. But the means by which to articulate these challenges have been identified. Moving this into praxis, that is reality, is another question altogether. Maybe I would highlight one other key factor in terms of the historic day 20 years ago, if you will, that the recognition that women are impacted more directly in situations of armed conflict was a crucial kind of global recognition. And that leads precisely to the next, if that's a premise, it leads to the following at minimum. If we know that there is greater impact on women in situations of armed conflict, then their participation in the resolution of those armed conflicts or political conflicts by necessity follows. And that has also fed into the shift from normative frameworks into what does this mean in reality? Thanks.
So the world was a bit different 20 years ago. When you look at the world today and the current conflicts and sort of the unstable situation we live in, does this situation highlight the need for women at peace tables? How would you analyze this?
I think that nowadays, when I think 20 years ago, the conflicts are more complex than ever. And there are more and more parties involved. And I think that there are a couple of very general facts why we do need more women. And very general, I mean, first of all, for example, inequality between women and men correlates with emergence of conflict as well as violent extremism in society. And secondly, as we all know, peace agreements that do not involve women, they are not lasting. And thirdly, it's also clear that women's participation in all these different points and parts of peace negotiating, making, they, of course, do strengthen the achievements of human rights.
Again, in full agreement with Anne, and I would add that because of this complexity, the strain and stresses of mechanisms that have been put in place are perhaps at times, and unfortunately oftentimes, revealing the inadequacies of some of the mechanisms that were put in place 20 years ago to address the challenges of today and the future. And there, clearly, all innovative new approaches to dealing with complex challenges, of which Anne identified some, should be put on the table. And there's even a more basic, practical question. If 50% of the world's population are women, then why would it even be a question that they should be involved in processes towards the resolution of conflicts that directly impact half of the world's population? So that's also a very practical matter. Speaking to the gaps from the past, not just 20 years ago, but prior to 20 years ago. And moving forward, I think we need to fully utilize all available resources based on the human experience to bring about sustainable solutions to some of the pressing challenges we face.
So how to put this in practice? You touched a bit upon the implementation of this resolution. What can you say about the implementation? What has been done, achieved?
Would you like to start?
Sure. I mean, there are, of course, conceptual barriers, right? From an anthropological, societal standpoint, Anne spoke of the challenges around religious extremism, not just extremism, but let's say societies in general that are holding on to certain myths that have prevented the full participation of all let's say, not just genders, but age groups, etc., into society. So the conceptual barriers are one thing, but also the means by which, yes, various states have advanced national action plans, but these two, unfortunately, are simply plans, in large part. And putting the available resources to enable implementation of not just the normative frameworks, but the plans there too, is we've fallen short on this, by all means. And in this respect, I think it's important to say that as an independent organization, CMI has attempted in our own humble way to try and bring about these changes in terms of how we convene, not everywhere, but in particular cases. So if we look at Libya, there is a basic understanding in all of the dialogue processes we facilitate where there is 50-50 representation around the table of men and women agreed to by all the principal parties. And that's held, as you know, for a few years. It's remarkable, not only because of the society that many would presume Libya to prevent that kind of fuller participation, but also the fact that it's in a situation of an ongoing armed conflict. And key individuals there have realized the importance of a broader, more inclusive, equal participation around the table. I could say more about this, but and perhaps you have further insights.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, if you mean that what has been achieved, of course, I completely agree with you that implementation is always very difficult. And I like to say that, of course, first of all, it's a question of resources. It's also the question of political will. And it's also the question, are men willing to share the power? Afghanistan is maybe the best example because when I mean, they still have, of course, a lot of difficulties to bring women to the table because there is always somebody, a very important chief from the countryside, of course, a man who needs a tribal chief, who needs to be represented on the table. And that's why it's true that implementation has been different and there is still a lot of work to be done. But I mean, of course, when I think about the positive side, I think that nowadays this Women, Peace and Security agenda is very well known all around in the world. And national action plans, as I said before, are in place in very many countries. And I'm particularly happy that, for example, in how much we have worked in places like Afghanistan, Middle East, Balkans, to implement those national action plans where women really need the support. And then also one point in general, I think that this adoption of this milestone resolution has put more focus on women and girls in the development field. So that more and more countries, I'm very proud and glad that Finland has always been very actively engaged when it comes to the root causes of conflict. Very many other countries are now putting root causes on focus. And also this has meant, and this means, that there is more concrete action when we do address the political and economic empowerment of women. And one thing I have also to point out, and that is coming from my experience in Balkans, that this resolution has helped the international community to bring very difficult issues on the table. And I would like to mention the victims of sexual-related violence. And of course, I mean, how we then help, how donors and how we can then help those women. And also I think that this resolution has also contributed to counter terrorism and violent extremism.
I mean, some of these figures are quite amazing. Still only 8% of peace negotiators and 4% of signatories in peace processes are women. But you would highlight, I mean, with more financial and maybe political resources, we could have more progress in this sense. Is this your your message also?
I mean, I think it's clear that there has been, and I have seen it personally, in those countries where I have been working, that Afghanistan, again, a very good example, there was not enough resources. And also that maybe from, I have to speak about the government, there was no political will. A lot of nice words, and especially very nice words when it comes to those speeches that everybody's delivering 8th of March, which is, of course, the International Women's Day. But then the political will is somehow missing.
Mm.
That is true. And I in general, again, I think that we need a very strong leadership, the international community, to keep these issues on the top of the agenda. And of course, now I'm looking to you and member states, meaning also that they have to have the courage to counter attacks on women, human rights, including sexual and reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm. But this is your message, Itonde, basically. More resources, political resources, financial resources, we could see more progress.
Well, yes. I mean, investment matters, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, we should be mindful that sustainable peace is not simply about the quote-unquote peace table.
Mm.
The involvement of women, and just to add that peace processes don't solely begin at a formal peace table either.
Mm. Mm.
And so the way in which the conflict analysis is done, the various quiet conversations trying to nurture space and understanding of either from a preventative lens or from really bringing an end to an ongoing armed conflict, how those processes also tap into a more inclusive lens and participation in preparing the table. And that's where we need to be even more creative in terms of preparation as well as prevention. I would perhaps add here that, yes, investment in terms of resources, but also there's a generational shift taking place.
Mm.
And so if institutions aren't up to date, whether they like it or not, societies around the world are moving. And alternative options will be explored, as we see in various parts, particularly of the Middle East, but also in parts of Africa, where this generational shift is really challenging basic kinds of practices and norms that have prevented the fuller participation of society more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where institutions like the UN and others will need to catch up and respond to the current perspectives of this world and not the perspectives of 75 years ago when it was established.
Yeah.
If I may add, I definitely agree with you that UN should also take stronger leadership when it comes to these issues. And then I think that we shouldn't forget the role of civil society, which is very, very important.
Mm. So what do you think, for example, the commitment of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that we need bold and urgent action instead of empty rhetoric. Is this the type of commitment you're looking for? Or how do you comment on this?
Well, if I may, I mean, our team, so CMI, we have decided in terms of investment to devote resources and expertise in the establishment of a women and peacemaking team who's focused on identifying tools, creating space for the broader participation of women in peace processes. And not exclusively, but really, as pointing to the example in Libya, involving in ongoing processes. Now, with respect to the Secretary General's statement that you referenced, I don't think the solution here is to simply add women to broken processes as a means to fix them, because it raises a question also in terms of the kinds of processes that are put in place that may actually not be, as you put it, and responding to root causes, systemic crises, but rather to really reform the whole way in which we look at the question of peace more broadly and think about it from a sustainable generational viewpoint. Now, more concretely, CMI, together and under the leadership of the United Nations and PRIO in Norway, have for the past 10 years devoted resources to convening a high-level seminar on the role of gender in peace processes, targeting special envoys and other individuals who have mandate, official mandate, to move forward peace processes. And over those 10 years, roughly 200 individuals have sat together and really reflected deeply from their own experience in light of normative frameworks. And I understand that has been a very, and you participated in the last one in Helsinki, has been a very healthy space to really question some of these basic practices around framings for peace processes. And in fact, the last session, this was the question. How do institutions like the United Nations, or can institutions like the United Nations, adapt to the reality of very complex competing interests that we see from Syria to Libya? And what does this mean for the fuller participation of all individuals in society, especially women? This is a big question.
Yes.
And that space has given opportunity to reflect more deeply on this, beyond the official mandate to reality.
Yeah, of course, I completely agree with you. It's also true that very often we focus on, when we speak about women as peacemakers, women's participation, we focus on quantity.
Yes.
And I have always said that that we should also focus on quality. But to your original question, I think that what was a sort of milestone for women peace negotiators, for women peacemakers, was last September when, and I was also there, when we launched the Global Alliance on Women Mediator Network. And that was, I mean this whole event was full of enthusiasm, and it was, if I kind of say that the adaption of 1325 20 years ago was a milestone, that launch was also a milestone. And I think that when I was referring here to the discussion quantity versus quality, that network sort of highlights that there are, that there is a large number, I mean, first of all, a large number of women, but there is a large number of women who do have very substantial experience in the field of peace and security. And also that launch sort of showed very well that women all around of the world are very much willing to participate and lead these complex processes.
So how to bring about this quality? It's not about quantity, but quality. What are sort of the concrete strategies and ways to do it? Itonen mentioned the GIM seminars that offers really practical know-how, different strategies, how to do it. What are your takes on this?
I would like to start by saying again that what is important, education, and once more, education. And as I'm coming from the MFA and have been working in different parts of the world, I'm very proud that how much support we do provide for girls' education in general. But then also what we should do maybe more and maybe together with, for example, with other Nordic countries, that we should commit more to educate women who do have potential to become peacemakers in their own country. And in that case, it's very important that we were very active with that in Afghanistan, that you don't only focus on women who live in the capital. I mean, these peace processes are so complex. All kind of women are needed. We need urban women, we need rural women, we need young, we need old, to educate that potential. And I guess that same goes to very many countries in Africa or in the Middle East, that there are a lot of women and girls who do have potential, but they need training. They need different kind of training. And we are, and especially Itonde CMI and also why not MFA, we do have means and les moyens to do that.
Any reflections on this?
You know, I'm going to go a little bit further back.
Yeah.
And here I speak as a student in light of education, education, of let's say, Finnish society and Nordic society more broadly, as a foreigner living here. And a few years ago, I was privileged to just observe the commemorations of Finland's centenary. And the following year, if I recall, also commemorations on coming out of civil war. And I think about that a lot in light of the types of issues we deal with at CMI. Why? Because we're talking about a century where really the benefits of forward-thinking systemic change were not realized until 50, 40, 30 years ago, and the fruits of which are being fully realized today. And that's not a perspective that's often put forward when talking about peace. Why do I say that? Your phrase on education was also fundamental to thinking about systemic change in a divided society. And I say this with great humility, also as a means to lay the foundations for a more egalitarian view of the world and the participation of women therein. And so when we look this weekend on Afghanistan, a place you know very well, Anne, I wonder to what extent are kind of this long generational visions being considered, particularly in a place like Afghanistan that's faced cyclical forms of violence, and the different type of approach that's required to bring about lasting peace. And here our founder, former President Ahtisaari, said to me recently that he is so thankful for the wisdom of his Finnish ancestors, more broadly Finnish, in terms of providing a framework, a vision that looked beyond themselves and contributed to a multi-generational view of how sustainable societies could really come about. Those are big questions, unfortunately, that aren't often brought up at the table for negotiating peace because it's about power sharing. It's about bringing an end to this immediate crisis. But of course, what happens after that? If it's solely about power sharing and recycling tired leaders, most of whom are men, then of course you're not going to address the core issues. And of course, you're not going to provide a lasting framework where you can give thanks for the wisdom of your ancestors.
Yeah, but is this to say that women are better in promoting and projecting this sort of long-term vision?
I speak with great humility again. However, I would question this.
Yeah.
Some would argue, yes. I would say, perhaps. Why perhaps? Because one of the myths that we need to do away with is a kind of purity of the perspective of women in society, that they are better than men or whoever it is in terms of making peace. No. Part of the foundation, if you will, of 1325 and the establishment of the global network of women mediators is also recognizing that women have a multifaceted role in society. On the one hand, as leaders, on the other hand, as being directly impacted as in situations of conflict, but also as participating in perpetuating conflict in societies. Mm. So we shouldn't look to some kind of mythic status of the role of women to bring about lasting peace. No, we should look to enabling women to participate fully in their various capacities and agencies.
If I may say something, I always say this in Afghanistan and also in the Middle East, that definitely we need also to engage with men. Mm. I mean, when we are speaking about women's role in the society in general and women's role in peacekeeping, and again, very often the focus is on quantity, not on quality. Women, they need also engage with men. We should not forget the men.
Absolutely. Mm.
And that was my message very often to the president of Afghanistan, that it's not only women, both of them, working together, because there are also very many men who are extremely willing and able to share power to promote women's roles.
To compromise,
etc. To compromise, etc. Mm. So they should work together.
Okay. So if we still look at some of the sort of concrete positive examples, Libya was mentioned here, Afghanistan. I think an interesting example of sort of current peace processes is the example of South Sudan. The South Sudanese peace process between 2013 and 18. There was a significant contribution from women. What are the key lessons learned from this process, Itonde?
Well, at face value, many would argue that women didn't participate fully, so to speak, in the various phases of South Sudan's peace process. Why would I say that? Because when you look even last week at the other agreement that is brought, or another agreement that is brought about the formation of the transitional government, very few women were observed. In fact, you saw the same faces as per the years prior, apart from a couple of very key prominent women leaders.
Yeah.
Now, that's the formal table, and that's the formal optics, even though they're problematic. Beneath that, what we have observed is something more profound in terms of at least one, in the case of South Sudan, advocacy at all levels. Secondly, the extensive preparations and engagement of women to prepare options behind the scenes, not getting the media attention, but behind the scenes. Thirdly, the kinds of alliances across divided lines, if you will, and geopolitical fault lines, the kinds of alliances that have been forged and created a potential, let's say, framework on which a more lasting peace could be based upon, also not in the limelight, but again, women advancing this. And a crucial point here being on community outreach. So who's telling the story? Who's translating the formal agreement into a way that the average South Sudanese citizen can appreciate that this peace has implications for me in a way that goes beyond the hand-to-mouth humanitarian assistance? The role of women there, and here I would lift up the legislative caucuses who have really been at the forefront of going beyond their constituencies, again, forging alliances beyond traditional geostrategic fault lines, if you will, in the country, and really saying this is about outreach to the South Sudanese people more broadly, and finally, pressure and persuasion as a key factor. And again, you're not going to get the attention for it. And if you get the attention, your ability to persuade and pressure becomes politicized or limited.
Yeah.
So those are some key areas in which we've observed from 2013 to 2018 that women have played a particular role in trying to nudge peace forward. Is the peace that has been announced again last week lasting or sustainable? Big question mark. Do we hope this is the case? Yes. Mm-hmm. And would these elements that women have been advancing provide the basis on which it can be sustainable? Absolutely, this is key. Now, the next bigger question, though, is does it get to the multi-generational view of building a society, or is it still solely focused on power sharing between an elite few? Mm. This is a big question mark. And of course, if it is focused there, then we'll be back to square one rather soon.
Mm. Anne, do you have any other examples of sort of positive examples of women's involvement in peace processes?
I mean, you mentioned Afghanistan, and maybe Afghanistan is not a best example, because what I realized during those 2 years that I was there was that, as I said actually before, that when everybody is very much willing to talk about women's role, but then it's very difficult for them to jump to the table when the real action is needed. And that's why I think, and what we have been talking in the ministry, is that now, especially if something is moving ahead in Afghanistan, and also, I mean, when it comes to the peace process, and also the internal discussion amongst Afghanis, now it's really crucial to make sure that women do have a place on those tables, but it's also sure that they really have to fight for it.
Mm. One thing that really comes to my mind is the current world situation we live in. There seems to be a growing insensitivity to women's rights in general when you look at some of the leading states' reluctance to uphold and promote women's rights. What kind of impact this has on inclusion of women in peacemaking?
I mean, I just think that this shows that world is not ready, and there was once one person who said that one step forward, two steps back, and unfortunately, maybe now we see that the face is this two steps back. I would like to once again stress. That we need strong leadership from, for example, UN, from the UN. I mean, UN and UN member states, they have to have the courage to show the leadership and go ahead with these issues, even though it seems to be very difficult at the moment.
Mm. It's on there.
Well, I think your question is fair and relevant, because the backsliding, if you will, on women's rights also relates to the backsliding on multilateral frameworks more broadly. And there we need to recognize that the means to preserve what has been known as the basis of how the world and the global community functions and comes together, these are being reinvented before our eyes.
Yeah.
And the gains around rights, human rights, should not be compromised or sacrificed at the table of re-envisioning a global world order for the future. And here, countries like Finland will have to play a really important role in ensuring that these gains are preserved.
So in conclusion, when you look at this 20th anniversary, Do you believe that this anniversary of the Resolution 1325 will give new momentum to strengthen women's role as peacemakers?
Well, I would just say, addressing one of the many myths around this question, we should not be looking for a one-size-fits-all solution in terms of the role of women in peace processes. Being attentive to contextual specificity and the realities of the places, many of which you've worked in, and being sensitive to this will be crucial. Whilst educating, providing tools and frameworks so that various societies can draw upon frameworks like 1325 that are established and normative, but mindful that the contextual specificity matters.
I do agree with you, and I would like to say that when it comes to the real success of this resolution 1325, it is measured only if we are able to make a concrete change into the lives of women and girls, and this equality of opportunities, it has to be provided in concrete actions, as Itonde mentioned, and not only in words, as it has been the case until now.
Thank you, Anne and Itonde. It was great to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to CMI's Peace Talks with Antti Ämmälä. If you like our show, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. You can also send us feedback and propose topics to discuss via social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or by sending email to comms@cmi.fi. Thank you.